Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. My name is John Preston. I'm the president of the Chartered Institute of Taxation. And it's my great privilege on behalf of both the CIOT and the Institute for Fiscal Studies to welcome you to this debate. I think this is the 11th debate of this kind we've held here over the last 3 to 4 years. And of course, in addition to that, we've held similar events like this at all the party conferences for the last several years. And the aim, as I'm sure you know, is to promote tax debate amongst people who actually understand tax. Whether we're succeeding or not, you can tell us afterwards. But tonight's topic is, I think, a very important one, the issue of business tax reliefs and incentives. Because the UK does have a very wide suite of tax reliefs and allowances for business. But the key question is whether this is an effective way in which to encourage investment, or is it, as some people claim, simply corporate welfare? Is this an efficient use, or are some of these reliefs effectively a waste of money? Well, tonight's panel is going to bring a very wide range of perspectives to this discussion. We have the perspective from business, from academia, from an economist, and from, if you will forgive me, a public sector watchdog. And after the speeches, we're going to open up the floor for general discussion. And we should have, I hope, a good sort of 35, 40 minutes or so to discuss these things and to get the perspectives from the panel. Anybody who is interested in doing so can, of course, contribute via Twitter at hashtag CIOTIFSDebates. It's on the slide up there. And, of course, we would be delighted if people in the audience would join us for a drink afterwards. So without further ado, let me introduce our first speaker, who I suspect needs very little introduction to anybody who's been to these events before, and that's Helen Miller. Helen, as I'm sure you know, is Associate Director and Head of Tax at the Institute for Fiscal Studies, and her main research interests are the effects of the tax system on individuals and firms' behaviour and the design of tax policy. Helen.
Thank you, John. So, the UK, according to the Office for Tax Simplification, has over 1,100 tax reliefs. HMRC count up just over 400 of them, and for the ones that they can cost, which is not all, but for those that they can cost, they calculate that we forego over £400 billion each year from those reliefs. £34 billion of that is on reliefs for corporation tax and capital gains tax. So they're pretty big numbers, and you can make them sound particularly big if you compare them to things like how much total spending the government does, that's about £800 billion, or to total corporate tax receipts, that's about £50 billion. But, I think there are a few big buts here. We shouldn't think that £414 billion is the amount of money you could raise if we scrapped all reliefs. So for a start, it has no behavioural response and accounts for no interactions between reliefs. So to give you an example, if we scrapped the annual investment allowance, we would expect more firms to use capital allowances and possibly to change their investment. So this isn't really a kind of how much revenue we could raise number. But the much bigger but, and the much more important one, I think, is that these, you know, really big numbers actually have very little meaning unless you know what a relief actually is, which in principle sounds very simple. Very broadly, a tax relief, whether it be a lower rate, an exemption, an allowance, is just a provision that makes a tax paid less than would normally be expected. But of course, that just instantly raises the question of, well, what's normal? In order to define a relief, we have to have a benchmark system against which to define that relief. And that gets tricky because there isn't one correct benchmark. In fact, countries use all sorts of different ideas. HMRC uses a very broad definition of what the benchmark system is, but then categorises reliefs. And in particular, it draws a distinction between those that can be regarded as an integral part of the tax structure and those that are designed to help or encourage particular types of activities in order to fulfil some economic or social objective. Now, I think this approach of conceptually classifying different types of reliefs is useful, if only because it points out that by definition, they're not all bungs of special interest. But there's clearly plenty of room for disagreement about which should go in which category. Something that I see as a tax relief, you might think of structural and vice versa. So what I'm going to argue is that regardless of how you want to define them or label them, the underlying question, if you want to think about which are good and which are bad or which is corporate welfare, the underlying question is always one of tax design. It's always a question of what is it we want to tax and what is it we want to incentivise. So my plan tonight is really to tell you about how, as an economist, I would think about comparing relief to some sensible design principles. But before I do that, one more word on the money. Here I'm showing you the top 10 reliefs, categories of reliefs, just in revenue, kind of foregone terms. These top 10 cost or forego $375 billion. And I think what you can instantly see is, even if you want to disagree with HMRC's classifications, most of these aren't what we would think of as corporate welfare. And there clearly aren't hundreds of billions of pounds sitting on the table easily for us to collect. A lot of these reliefs, such as the income tax personal allowance, are pretty popular, and we wouldn't be able to just scrap them at no cost. If we think about the four at the bottom, these are what fits into more of the corporate tax relief category. And I think these are probably more what people have in mind when they think of tax relief. So things like R&D tax credits, entrepreneurs relief. And if I went further down the list of revenue costs, you'd see things like enterprise investment scheme, patent boxes, film tax reliefs. They're more what comes in mind when we think about reliefs. Now, I think we should evaluate all such reliefs, and we probably want to scrap a bunch of them. But in order to do that, we need to dig into the details of each specific one and work out what is it for and how is it working. So to give you a sense of how we might do that when we dig in, what are we going to do? One thing you might be surprised to hear is that I'm not going to argue that reliefs are bad in general. I think economists can't often be accused of articulating their ideas super clearly, but one idea that seems to have got traction is that economists like a broad base and a low rate. And there's definitely something to that. Basically, all taxes have distortions, by which I mean they change people or firms' behaviours, often in ways we think are undesirable. And therefore, we don't want to load all of those distortions on one very narrow base. So a broad base is good from that point of view. And when we exempt some activities or incomes, we create boundaries in the tax system. And it's often those boundaries that lead to complexity and to avoidance opportunities. So there's something very sensible behind the broad-based, low-rate mantra. But economists actually often want a narrow base and high rates. So North Sea Oil is a great example of this. North Sea Oil, we have very generous reliefs for all investment expenditure, including decommissioning expenditures, and then we actually have relatively high rates. And most economists will tell you that's a good thing. So I think this broad-based low rates often isn't very helpful in helping people think about when do economists want broad bases and when do they want narrow bases. So I'm going to suggest what I think is a better, albeit less snappy, rule of thumb, which is that we should tax all income, but then deduct all costs of generating taxable income. Now, I clearly haven't got time right now to go through all of the design principles that sit behind that. I'll show you some examples of how it gets applied. But the sort of intuition is that we want to, when we're designing a tax, we accept there are distortions, but we want to minimise the number of distortions that we impose. And we can do that sometimes by not taxing all income. So a simple example, if I have a pound today and I save it and have a pound tomorrow, we don't necessarily want to tax that pound in both periods, because doing so would put me off from saving and consuming tomorrow. And there's no really good reason, as a first pass, there's no good reason to try to manipulate that decision. So if we're trying to minimise distortions, we want to deduct all of the costs of generating taxable income. I'm happy to get into later more about why that's good for both efficiency, but also for fairness in the system. So I'm going to show you an example of that, but I'll note in passing that even this rule of thumb, although I think it's actually very good and gets you a long way, there can be reasons to depart from it. One that I'll touch on is the idea of market failures or externalities. That's when, rather than the benchmark being we want to minimise distortions, the government goes out of its way to try to change people's behaviours. One thing I won't say anything about at the moment is redistribution goals. They are clearly super important, but it is almost always the case that you're better to try to achieve your redistributive goals through the tax rates rather than manipulating the tax base. So I'm going to park that for now. So that's kind of pretty slightly abstract. Let me show you a real example. So capital allowances. The application of the rule of thumb that says tax all income but deduct all of the costs of generating taxable income translates for the corporate tax base into it's desirable to tax profits and not turnover. In particular, we want to do that because we don't want to favour low-cost, low-revenue activities over equally valuable but high-cost, high-revenue activities. Think of it another way. If you have two businesses that are earning the same revenues, but one has zero employees and one has 10 employees, you don't want to disincentivise the latter business. And with employment, that's kind of non-controversial. We allow businesses to deduct the cost of employing other people. But we should do the equivalent thing for investment. We should allow them to deduct the cost of investment, which in principle is quite simple. It gets tricky because we have to answer the question, well, what is the cost of investment? You could think of it as the cost of having to cover the depreciation of assets. Capital allowances try to do something like that. You could think of it as the upfront cost of how much money you have to fork out upfront to pay for a machine, for example. The annual investment allowance does that for some investments. And you can think about the financing costs that you have to bear to be able to do any investment at all. And there we allow the deduction for interest, but not for the equivalent deduction of equity. So the upshot of what we currently have in the UK is that our system gets it right sometimes, by which I mean, by chance, there are some assets and some financing in which the tax system isn't distorting or subsidising investments. Most often, it's distorting it or subsidising it, and not because it's well designed, but because nobody really thought about how these things interacted or understood the interactions. So without going to get into lots more details here, sort of the policy punchline is that we should remove the distortion to investment. There are lots of ways to do that. It's something that IFS has been talking about for decades. Some people in the room here have been involved in those discussions, and we've written about it lots of times. You have to dig into the details and think about the interactions for reliefs to get that right, but we could do it. But even if we could design the ideal, you know, IFS design tax base, that would still include deductions for investment costs. So we shouldn't be expecting to see a system where we scrap all capital allowances. So this is an example where I think it's interesting because it's a case where we have reliefs in order to reduce the distortions in the tax system. So it's kind of saying there are just some forms of income we never want to tax in the first place because we want to get those distortions down. But as I alluded to earlier, the government also has a bunch of tax reliefs. I think these are more what people have in mind when they think of reliefs, where the government is going out of its way to try to incentivise some kind of behaviour. And I think R&D tax credits are a good example of that. So I'm going to run through is how I think about, you know, how we evaluate these types of policy where the government's trying to get involved in encouraging something. So I think first question is, what's the policy justification? I think with R&D, that's quite straightforward. R&D can produce spillovers, by which I mean a firm that is investing in coming up with new ideas or new innovations creates some benefits that aren't only captured by the firm itself, but that spill over to the wider community. Other firms learn from it, other inventors learn from the technologies. And because not all the benefits are captured by the firm doing the R&D, they do less than would be optimal if at a society level we could decide the amount of R&D. So that gives some justification for the government to get involved in boosting the amount of R&D. But then the question is R&D tax credit a good way to do that? Well, what I'll say about that is that one very good thing about them is that they are directly targeted at the thing we want to more of. So we want more R&D expenditure, they are a credit that is bigger the more R&D expenditure you do. So that makes a lot of sense. They don't only back high profit projects, unlike something like a patent box, and that's important because we actually don't want to only back high profit projects. In fact, they're the ones that are likely to go ahead regardless of the tax regime. Instead, we want to be finding those marginal projects that might not have happened, including projects that might fail, because they can still be important for learning in society. So targeting expenditure is good for that. But it does have the implication that it means that we'll be giving a tax break to some profits that would have happened without the tax relief. So it's not perfect. There is a cost to doing this kind of policy. So then the question, there are costs and benefits, we have to evaluate it. R&D tax credits is actually an example where in the academic literature there's lots of evaluations. We have some good tax data that allows us to get a handle on this. And the punchline from that is that for every pound of tax credit, you get more than a pound of R&D back, and you get more R&D happening in the economy. So that puts us in a good position to be able to work out whether the benefits of this kind of policy outweigh the costs. So that's R&D tax credits. I think something that stands in stark contrast to that is entrepreneurs' relief. So as I'm sure many of you will know, this is a significant tax break, capital gains tax break for most company owner managers. So again, running through the same structure I had before, what's the policy justification? The honest answer is, I'm not sure. Usually, people will respond with something like, it's to encourage risky or entrepreneurial activity. I think that's a pretty poorly defined goal. What we need to really be focusing on is, what is the activity that we want to get more of? What's creating spillovers? The fact that something is risky or difficult doesn't mean we want to necessarily subsidise it. In fact, there are plenty of really risky things that people do that we should not be subsidising. So I think we need to be much more specific about, is it new firms, is it firms that are innovating, is it firms employing, what is it we're trying to target? Whatever it is we are trying to target, is it doing a good job? Well, I think no, because it's given to basically all closely held company owner managers. I think that's very unlikely to be a good proxy for entrepreneurial activities. Plenty of people are doing, you know, perfectly respectable business activities, but they're not particularly entrepreneurial. And even if we think that kind of small businesses is the best proxy we've got, the relief only benefits those who can take their incoming capital gains. So that all the companies that are loss-making don't benefit, or the individuals who need to take their money out of their company in the short run and can't wait, you know, until the end of their company life, aren't benefiting from this policy. So I think it's a very poorly targeted in that sense. Is it cost-effective? Well, there's no evaluation in sort of academic literature about the benefits, but we do know that it comes with pretty large distortions. In fact, we're doing some research at IFS looking at tax records, and it's really pretty surprising how these company managers respond quite sharply to the tax incentive. So we think that entrepreneurs' relief is distorting people's behaviours, not necessarily in a good way. So I'd be surprised if it ended up being a cost-effective policy. The last thing to note is that higher capital gains tax rates, so if we scrapped entrepreneurs' relief, that would be a higher capital gains tax rate, would discourage saving the investment. That's not a good thing. But what we'd say is that getting rid of those disincentives is better dealt with through the tax base. So going back to what I said earlier, we should be thinking about capital allowances and about the treatment of losses and about indexation of capital gains. So there are lots of things we could do there, but they don't necessarily require this tax break for entrepreneurs. So let me sum up by saying I started with some headline-grabbing numbers, and hopefully what I've convinced you is that on their own, they're not particularly informative. The debate always has to come down to one of tax design and what it is we're trying to do with the tax system. This is a case where I think actually some more transparency on policy goals would help us have that debate about individual reliefs. I ran you through three very quick evaluations of three particular policies, but I think we should apply those same design principles to the larger suite.